for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Welcome to the American Federation of Government Employees Inside Government Program, brought to you in part by Purchasing Power and MetLife. Now here's your host, Jason Fornicola.
This week we'll discuss GovLoop's upcoming Next Generation of Government Training Summit with founder and president Steve Ressler. We'll also look more closely at the Affordable Care Act with Emily Martin and Judy Waxman from the National Women's Law Center and Ian Millhiser from the Center for American Progress. But first, Campaign for America's Future co-director Roger Hickey joins us to discuss the Buffett Rule. Roger, welcome back to the program.
Glad to be with you, Jason.
So, Roger, this week the Senate struck down the Buffett Rule by a vote of 51 to 45. What's your reaction to the vote?
Well, it's clear that the Republicans in the Senate were protecting their patrons, the wealthy, and many of these senators are wealthy themselves. The Buffett Rule is a common sense proposition, first elaborated by Warren Buffett, the millionaire investor, who basically said it's a crime, it's a shame that he is paying a lower rate on his income and taxes than his secretary or his chauffeur. So the Republicans who voted to prevent the Buffett Rule from coming into effect are basically protecting millionaires who have been paying a smaller and smaller and smaller percentage of their income to keep the American government that contributes so much to their prosperity actually running.
Roger, had the vote gone a different way and the rule would have been enacted, what would that have meant for middle-class, working-class Americans?
Well, first of all, it would have been a first step toward fairness in the tax code. It would have been a first step toward the idea that we're all in this together and that we have a progressive income tax and that wealthy people who have done well in our economy should pay a higher rate. So fairness is the most important thing. It also, in this time of budget deficits and sacrifice by everybody, it would have raised $47 billion over 10 years to protect programs that are now being cut to reduce the deficit. So it's ironic that the pundits on the conservative sides have poo-pooed the idea that $47 billion is not much money and therefore this Buffett Rule is useless. As I recall, when the federal workers' pay freeze was instituted, it was announced that something like it would save $28 billion over 5 years. And that was championed as something that was worth doing by the conservatives. $47 billion over 10 years would go a long ways to preventing that kind of sacrifice by middle-class Americans.
Roger, so you're of the mindset that basically any little bit helps in this situation when we're trying to level out the budget and preserve programs?
I think it's ironic that the conservatives are willing to sacrifice middle-class programs that cost in the realm of $47 billion and say that that's necessary, but they're not willing to sacrifice when it comes to raising their own taxes. And the Buffett Rule, frankly, is just a first installment on getting the tax system more fair, a comprehensive tax reform that actually raises more money from the wealthy. And really, when the Republicans and the conservatives talk about tax reform, they're talking about cutting tax rates for the wealthy, and they continue to do that. This is going to be a major, major battle through the election year.
Roger, you had mentioned that the revenue from the Buffett Rule would protect programs that are being cut, social programs for middle-class Americans. Talk a little bit more about that and how important some of those programs are.
Well, we reject the idea that we ought to be in austerity mode right now. But the conservatives in the Congress have persuaded President Obama to cut a lot of programs have to do with protecting children, have to do with financing for college education. And we've already seen things like the budget freeze for federal workers. The conservatives are also now talking about getting rid of food stamps for people who are down on their luck, child protective services, all kinds of programs, the child tax credit to poor children. Their proposals are draconian. And they would rather cut these programs for middle class and poor people and children than raise taxes on anybody who's making over $1 million a year. So this is going to be a battle over the next period. And the polling shows that average Americans, by large majorities, 67%, I believe, is the last poll that I saw, believe that the wealthy should abide by Warren Buffett's rule that none of them should pay a lower rate than the secretaries and chauffeurs and people who work for them at a middle class income. It's a common sense idea. At a time when we're trying to find the money to pay for important programs, and we're trying to reduce the deficit as well.
You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, and we're here with Roger Hickey, the co-director of the Campaign for America's Future. Roger, what's next for the Buffett rule, despite the defeat in the Senate? Is there a way to revive the initiative in some other form?
Well, I think there's all kinds of activity going on this week. Or before and after tax day by groups around the country who are doing demonstrations, who are doing vigils, who are doing even some civil disobedience around the idea that the wealthy ought to pay their fair share. So I think there's going to be an ongoing Occupy Wall Street kind of agitation around the country. Around the idea that it's time for the wealthy to pay the kind of rates that they were paying under the Clinton years, when the country was very prosperous and wealthy people were also investing. I don't think there's much of a chance, as long as we have this Congress, to get much in the way of real tax reform. But I do think that it's going to become a major political issue. Everybody around the country ought to be asking candidates where they stand in terms of the rich paying their fair share. We're not talking about confiscation. We're just talking about a common sense idea that the tax code ought to be progressive. And we ought to also uncover those candidates who are really talking about cutting taxes for the wealthy. I mean, they got the Bush tax cuts and they want to make them permanent, but the Republican conservative version of tax reform is really lower the tax rates for the wealthy even more, get rid of the inheritance tax, and we need congressional district by congressional district to ask each candidate, do they stand for making the wealthy pay their fair share, or do they stand for cutting the taxes for the wealthy even more? If we expose where candidates stand, I think we'll get a much better Congress as a result.
Roger, how do tax rates for the wealthiest Americans today compare to years past?
Well, you know, it's been a steady erosion of the progressive tax system. You know, during World War II and shortly after World War II, actually for a good long time after World War II, tax rates for the wealthy were in the 80% and 90% range. That was in the old days when people believed in government. We had won a world war, and it was not questioned at all that the wealthy who benefit from the system that we have here in America should pay a large percentage of their income. Even Ronald Reagan, who did cut taxes, was committed to the idea that millionaires and billionaires should not pay a lower tax rate than bus drivers. That's a quote from Ronald Reagan. But with the Reagan tax cuts and then the Bush tax cuts, which were widely seen as massive windfalls to the wealthy, our tax rate and our tax system has become less and less progressive. And these proposals that are on the table from the conservatives would make the wealthy pay even less in terms of their tax rates. So this is a ironic battle. The same people who are making such a big deal of the federal deficit are trying to punch a hole in the revenue system that finances government and sustains prosperity. This is going to be a major battle through the political year, and hopefully the new government that gets elected is going to have a mandate to produce a more productive and more fair tax system.
Roger, speaking of elections, as we look ahead to the upcoming presidential election between President Obama and presumably Governor Mitt Romney, what do you think the key issue is going to be there?
Well, I do think the key issue is going to be jobs. It's going to be how do we get the economy growing again after the huge blow that we took and almost forcing us into a Great Depression. The Obama position is we need to invest in the future. We need to invest in the kind of things that make America more productive, that educate our children, that build a better future. The Romney Republican position is let's do more tax cuts. Let's hope that the wealthy invest and it trickles down to the rest of us. A familiar proposal, a set of proposals that sound just like out of the George Bush playbook. So that's going to be the battle ahead. I think most Americans realize that the Bush agenda meant a huge windfall for the wealthy, but not much for the rest of us, and certainly not the production of jobs that the conservatives propose. So we need to find the revenue to invest in the things that make America more productive. And that requires everybody paying their fair share in taxes. That's going to be one of the big debates as we go into the fall elections.
Roger Hickey, co-director of the Campaign for America's Future. Thank you for your time, Roger. Always great to talk to you.
Thank you, Jason, and talk to you soon.
You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. I'm your host, Jason Fornicola, and up next, GovLoop founder and president Steve Ressler will join us to discuss the next generation of government training summit.
Attention AFGE members, are you in need of a new computer or home appliance but can't spare the upfront cash? Discover Purchasing Power, an exclusive benefit available to AFGE members where you can buy brand name laptops, tablets, and home appliances through 12 months of easy payroll deduction. No upfront cash or credit check required. Shop now and get an 8% AFGE member only discount with promo code AFGE member. That's all one word. Learn more, visit shoppurchasingpower.com today.
Did you know MetLife Auto and Home has valuable deals on insurance for AFGE members that could save them hundreds every year? Benefits include special discounts just for being an AFGE member, and in most states, a deductible credit for claim-free driving up to $250. To see how much you could save, call the AFGE Benefits Hotline at 1-888-844-2343 to get the members-only phone number from MetLife. That's 1-888-844-2343. Underwritten by Metropolitan Group Property and Casualty Insurance Company, Warwick, Rhode Island.
Welcome back to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. We've been joined by Steve Ressler, the founder and president of GovLoop. Steve, welcome back to the program.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So the GovLoop Next Generation of Government Summit is coming up in July, the 26th and the 27th. Tell us about the summit, Steve.
Yeah, so this kind of goes back to one of the things that I, when I was first a Fed, so I came out of grad school and I worked with at the Department of Homeland Security. There's really no one within my generation at my agency. So a couple of friends and I got together and started a happy hour that turned into a professional development organization called Young Government Leaders, which is the young professional organization for feds. And we always wanted to do kind of a training and learning event for kind of Gen X, Gen Y government leaders, and also kind of bridge that barrier between Gen X, Gen Y, and the baby boomers and really learn from each other. So a couple years ago, as GovLoop was growing, I reached out to the folks, the current president of YGL, and said, why don't we do a GovLoop Young Government Leaders Next Generation of Government Training Summit? It's really the goal of the event is to train and energize our next generation of government leaders.
That sounds fantastic. Why would a federal worker attend this summit? What will they get out of it?
Yeah, so the first thing, which I don't think we talk enough about in government, is why we get into public service. It's often because of the mission and the energy that we want to give back. So the folks in government are very different than the folks at Goldman Sachs or folks like that. That we do it because we care. But often you get beat up every day. So I was talking to an acquaintance the other day who'd been in the summit, and she said she was really close to quitting government. She was, you know, her energy was low. She wasn't feeling she was able to make a change. And she said after she came to the summit, she realized there's tons of people like her. She said she got the energy to make the change, that what they're doing matter. And she said, I got really practical tips. So we really try to make this, it's a training event, so real practical tips on being a manager for the first time, how to lead organizations and change, how to actually do project management well. So we really try to make it the tools you need as a leader with some inspiration in there as well.
Steve, in terms of practical tips and training sessions, I noticed that you'll have one on financial literacy and also one on living a healthy lifestyle. How do those things fit into being a productive federal employee?
Yeah, so I think there's two key ways it ties in well. So first of all, financial literacy is important, I think, both at the individual and organizational level. So what we find, especially young feds, and you probably talked to Michelle, the Roth 401k is going to come to the TSP. A lot of folks don't really understand how the TSP works. They don't understand their options. And, you know, as budgets get cut, you know, there's less of that kind of internal training on how to navigate that, the benefit structure, which becomes really important because agencies want their staff to be able to use the benefits, use them in the right way. And then second of all, you know, on a higher level, which we'll get into a little bit there and then some other sessions, I don't think we talk enough about how the current Fed, a lot of what they do is money and budget. So whether you're a project manager, a budget analyst, or HR person, a large part of your role more and more these days is getting a budget or a shrinking budget, finding out the best ways to use that budget, spend it on contractors, products, hiring internally. So just financial literacy is, I think, just really important for the 21st century Fed, both at an individual level. So you have your house in order at home, and then also getting your house in order at your agency.
Steve, do you find people who attend the summit and maybe participate in some of those financial literacy sessions who shore things up at home and then are also able to apply some of those same lessons to their professional lives at the workplace?
Exactly. Yeah, I think they're integrated. They're totally tied together, especially in 2012. The divide between work life, is getting grayer and grayer. And if you don't have your house in order at home, if you're behind on retirement, that make you create other changes in your life, whether it's leaving for a different job or just the stress of that, which hurts your productivity at work. So just getting your house in order home, really, when you come to work, you're in a much better space when you feel comfortable. And what I love about the federal government benefits, it's not that complicated if you get just a little bit of advice. So, I'm not your financial guy for today, but there's just some basic stuff of, hey, every young Fed, you should be putting at least 5% in your TSP because that's the match you get. And, if you don't want to think the lifestyle 2040 or 2050 retirement plans going to get you an A-minus result. So just getting those tips, you know, helps a ton. And it's amazing how many folks don't follow that, where I meet folks that are, you know, 25 years old and ask, you know, you've been working 3 years. What do you do at TSB? Oh, I can't afford to put any money in there yet. And I'm like, well, you just, you know, that's the worst. This is the best time, you know. Try the Starbucks, cut a night out, and it's going to end up, you know, tens and twenties and hundreds of thousands of dollars, you know, 50 years later.
Steve, at the top, you mentioned your efforts to integrate members of Gen X, Gen Y, and baby boomers. How has that gone?
You know, it works out pretty good. And then this kind of comes on two pieces. So one is I find there's a lot of perceived animosity between kind of X, Y, boomers. But when you actually come at the topic with people that care and want to learn, it's easily solvable. So this partly comes out of on GovLoop. We do an online mentoring program where we match 50 mentors and 50 mentees. We're actually in the process of our second one right now. And we found that actually people love to share. You know, if you're a mentor, you love to give back. Most people who got into public service do because they care. They like teaching the next generation. And most mentees, you know, love to learn. It's just, how do we structure that and learn the common vernacular? So, you know, both sides, so it comes off the right way. So I know we've had sessions last year, we have one this year. Just, you know, what are some practical tips? So, hey, you know, some of it's just really cultural. So, for example, when you, you know, you talk about, you know, D-Day, it's not relatable to a 27-year-old. But if you say, if you can put it in the context of, hey, D-Day is very similar to 9/11 to you, and here's how it's kind of similar, and you can kind of share an emotional bond of how you think through, you know, disasters and how those work. Or, for example, with new technology, if you just say, ah, Twitter's stupid, I don't care about new tech. But if you're open-minded enough and you say, hey, you know, I remember when email came in my organization in the 90s, and I was the young person. I was telling everyone to get on email, and everyone was pushing back. I realized Twitter's like that now, and I want to learn from you. Tell me why it mattered. I'm skeptical, but I'm open to learn. So that's the biggest thing, is just both sides being open to learn. And really, there's some small tweaks just on language issues. And, you know, I've seen just some stuff myself when, you know, when the mentor always talks about having a child your age, all of a sudden it hurts the relationships because you're no longer, you're just their child and they're kind of talking down to you. But if you focus it on a business capacity, it works a lot better.
You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, and we're speaking with Steve Ressler, founder and president of GovLoop. Steve, on this notion of Twitter, what role will social media play at the summit?
Yeah, so we integrated social media, and actually we just did a call for topics. We did it a couple weeks ago, so we try to make the training conference be about our members and what they want to learn about. So we asked for a call for topics, both on GovLoop. So we had a discussion forum on GovLoop. We asked questions on Twitter and Facebook. You know, we integrated, you know, did the in-person email as well. But so we always try to integrate social media the way we're doing it. And then also this year we have a mobile app. So it's pretty cool. We're going to do a couple contests with it, both integrating taking photos at the event, as well as integrating Twitter, so to be live tweeting from the event. And last year we took questions both from GovLoop and Twitter live in the event and streamed those. So I'm a big believer in basically blended learning. So, you know, how do you integrate online, offline to create kind of great experiences?
What can attendees learn in terms of leadership development at the summit?
Yeah, I think there's so the best thing I think about leadership in the public sector is there's two types of things that go on. So there's general leadership tips that can come from just, you know, reading the great books, learning from folks. And then there's some that are very public sector focused. So last year we had a great author who wrote this book, Change, and it was all about, it's actually called Consider. And it was a one word with a C. It's called Consider. And he had interviewed David Petraeus, Thad Allen, and talked about how do you make leadership and actually make big changes in government, because it is different in government. There's different motives. It's not about money. It's not about ROI in the pure economic sense. A lot of it can be, you know, there's dealing with Congress. There's dealing with the media. There's dealing with federal, state, locals, vendors. So we talk a lot about that in government. How do you actually make these big changes And I actually think it's a great time for it because government, with the budget shrinking, we really need to reconsider how we do things because we can't just do it the same way. So we talk a lot about that, and then we bring in people that have done it. So we've had some great folks. I know this year we're going to try to get some folks from the White House. We have some people lined up from CDC and EPA, people that have started big programs and made big changes. So that's our biggest thing is I think you learned a lot about leadership by hearing the best practices from folks in government that have done it. And also they can talk a little bit about how hard it is. Because I think that's one thing we find kind of from our attendees is they feel like it's really hard, you know, trying to make change in government. And it really is, but it helps them a lot hearing, hey, this super successful person ran into the same roadblocks that I did, and I shouldn't give up. Because I think a lot of people, maybe it's a cultural thing of the helicopter parents and everyone getting A's and ribbons growing up, that they're like, oh, I didn't know it was going to be this hard. I thought I just, you know, would tell my boss it's a great idea and, you know, tomorrow things would change. So I think a lot of it's a matter of perspective, too.
Steve, if someone wants to learn more or sign up for the conference, where can they find you?
Yeah, so easiest place, NextGenGov. So it's NextGenGovT.com. You can actually email me personally too. It's steve@govloop.com, steve@govlop.com. Happy to share info. And we're actually doing, we're launching early next week a contest for speakers. So we're going to have three folks speak for 5 minutes at the conference that are doing something really innovative in their agency. Anyone can apply. So I encourage you to apply. If you think you're doing something really cool at your agency, or maybe you just have a really good idea. We had a good idea last year, which was around how do you change the end of the fiscal year process. This person had this kind of really interesting idea of saving money there. If you have a really interesting idea like that, then submit that on our website or steve@govloop.com.
Steve, before we close out here, I noticed that GovLoop put out a great resource for aspiring feds or those within the federal sector maybe looking to change jobs, and that's your GovLoop Career Guide. Give us a quick summary of that.
Yeah, so I encourage people to check out. So what we do on GovLoop often is we take the best of what goes on every day on GovLoop in our blogs and discussions and talk to our members and create these guides. So we just launched one on careers, which it's about kind of four things. It's finding a government job, but also once you're in, how to get to the next level and find your next government job. And there's kind of great practical tips on, you know, some of it's on how to navigate USA jobs, how to navigate details, and opportunities like that, which people don't often know about as much. And then some real practical kind of career advice that we've gotten both from our experts and blogs and discussions online. And I think there's just a lot of stuff that's really good in there, you know, but when I talk to a lot of feds, they often come to me and they complain. They're like, hey, I'm just stuck. I'm a GS-12. I can't get ahead. I'm not on the project I want. And I said, well, you know, how do we change that? And so guides like this is really our tips of okay, you're in that situation. How do you get to the next level? Here's some real practical tips on, you know, finding a mentor, finding your next project. You know, maybe you do need to change agencies or divisions of your agency. If so, how do you do that and find the right jobs on USA Jobs?
And Steve, that can be downloaded from your website there at GovLoop, right?
Yep, just govloop.com. You can download it. It's free, and it's just a resource. And just generally overall, we have a pretty robust career section where we found a lot of the feds on our site just love tips and advice on how to get ahead in their career. Someone that's exec coaching level, dealing with problems at a high level. Some of it's junior, try to get to the mid-level. So we have an online mentoring program. We have a free resume review service where we review 10 resumes a month. We have the online mentors program. And then we also have a job section where we pick the top 10 government jobs from USA Jobs by category, acquisitions, technology, communications each week, and send those out.
Steve Ressler, founder and president of GovLoop. Always fun having you on the program, Steve. Thanks for taking the time today.
Cool. Thanks, buddy.
You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. I'm your host, Jason Fornicola, and up next, we'll look at the Affordable Care Act's impact on women with Emily Martin and Judy Waxman of the National Women's Law Center.
Planning a family vacation? Did you know through your AFGE membership, you are eligible for discounts for you and your family when you travel to Busch Gardens, Adventure Island, Knott's Berry Farm, and SeaWorld? And if you want to capture those family moments on film, your union membership will help you get a discount on a camcorder or digital camera. Those are just some of the benefits offered by the American Federation of Government Employees, the nation's largest federal workers union, representing some 600,000 workers nationwide. If you are a member, simply go to the AFGE website and click on the Member Benefits tab or call 888-844-2343. That's 888-844-2343. Not a member? Become one. Log on to AFGE.org and click the Join AFGE button on the homepage. AFGE, proud to make America work.
Welcome back to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. We've been joined by Emily Martin, the Vice President and General Counsel of the National Women's Law Center. Welcome to the program.
Thanks so much. It's great being here.
Today is a historic day. The Supreme Court is taking a close look at the constitutionality of the Affordable Care Act, the health care law, just steps across the street from us right now. What are your impressions of this from a legal perspective?
Well, what I think is the Supreme Court should really be focusing on how the Affordable Care Act, in many ways, is following in the tradition of civil rights laws and anti-discrimination laws that the Supreme Court has long recognized Congress has the authority to pass. And that's because addressing discrimination against women in health insurance and barriers that women face in the health insurance and health care market is a real primary motivating purpose behind the Affordable Care Act. And addressing the economic impact of that discrimination, those obstacles, is part of why the law is constitutional.
When you look at this case and its particulars from a legal perspective, how do you see the court analyzing it and then making a decision?
Well, what I hope the court does is look at the long precedent that brought us here, which I think clearly shows the Affordable Care Act is constitutional. So the challengers to the individual responsibility provision, the mandate, say that it's unconstitutional because it forces you to do something you don't want to do. But what I think is important, what I hope the Supreme Court recognizes, is that it's long been the case under civil rights laws, under anti-discrimination laws, that people sometimes will have to do things that they otherwise don't want to do, like rent rooms in a hotel to somebody who's a person of color, even if they would rather not do that. And what the court has held in the past is that Congress has the power to pass those sorts of laws because those laws represent regulation of commerce. Just as a law saying you have to rent someone a room, regardless of their race, is a law about how and when you participate in the market for hotels. So the personal responsibility provision, the mandate, is a rule about how and when you pay for health insurance, that you can't wait until you need it and then shift the bill for your care off to the rest of society.
What is the court going to be looking at over the next few days? What are the things that are going to be coming up in there?
Well, I think the court's going to be looking at how the Affordable Care Act addresses economic problems in the country and the extent to which the individual responsibility provision is a necessary component of the solution that the Affordable Care Act poses to the problems of health insurance and access to health insurance in the country. So what I think the court will recognize is that the personal responsibility provision is an essential part of this effort to make sure that everybody has access to health insurance, to affordable health insurance, regardless of whether they're a man or a woman, regardless of whether they have a pre-existing condition, and that this is an appropriate part of Congress's answer to that problem.
Let's talk about if the court upholds the law. What happens to someone who says, I can't afford it or I can't pay it? What do they do then?
Well, there are subsidies available for people who can't afford health insurance. There's subsidies that will be available to millions of low-income and moderate-income people. If someone chooses not to buy health insurance, even despite that subsidy, then there will be a penalty that they have to pay, but it's not as though they're thrown into prison. It's a penalty, and people could make that choice. But what the Affordable Care Act does is make it possible for people to make the choice to have insurance.
Has it been determined what that penalty would be for those who were either unwilling or unable to pay?
It's a relatively modest penalty. I don't know the dollar figure right now, but it's a relatively modest penalty, which is one of the reasons why this provision is fully constitutional.
Let's talk a little bit about the benefits of the Affordable Care Act and what it means to regular working class people.
Well, I think the Affordable Care Act is of the utmost importance for women and their families. And it's really one of the untold stories about the health care law, how it really makes a difference for women and their families in their day-to-day lives. So some examples. Already, the Affordable Care Act is making preventive care more available to women. It's especially important to women because women are more likely than men to forego preventive care because of cost. Under the Affordable Care Act, women now have access to things like mammograms and pap smears without any sort of copay or cost sharing. And later this year, we'll also have access to contraception, to well women care, to domestic violence screenings, to lactation consulting, all without any sort of copay, which is really important. The Affordable Care Act also ends what is an incredibly widespread practice in the individual insurance market of charging women more than men for the same coverage. So right now, most plans in the individual insurance market charge female non-smokers more than male smokers for the same coverage. It's just discriminatory and it's wrong, and the Affordable Care Act will end that. The Affordable Care Act also makes sure that maternity coverage is part of the package of health benefits that every insurance plan will have to cover. Again, a protection that women, especially in the individual insurance market, really truly need. And it ensures, perhaps most importantly of all, that women and others will have access to insurance regardless of any pre-existing conditions. So women will no longer be told, you can't get insurance here because you've had a cesarean section in the past, or because you've had treatment for domestic violence, or because you've been sexually assaulted in the past, which were all reasons before the insurance company said you have a pre-existing condition and are excluded from coverage.
You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. We're here with Emily Martin, the Vice President and General Counsel of the National Women's Law Center. Emily, from the things that you just described, it really seems like the Affordable Care Act levels the playing field here quite a bit.
I think that's absolutely right. As I said, the Affordable Care Act, a primary purpose that Congress had in passing the Affordable Care Act was improving women's health and making health insurance and health care more available to women. As Speaker Pelosi said the night that the House passed the health care law, now being a woman will no longer be a pre-existing condition. And that's exactly right.
What is your favorite part of the Affordable Care Act?
Well, there are so many good options.
If you had to pick one.
I think that one part of the Affordable Care Act, which people don't know enough about and which is of huge importance, is that for the first time now, there is a provision in federal law that says health programs, health plans, insurance programs can't discriminate on the basis of sex. That was not the law before. Now there's a rule that says if you're a health program and you receive any sort of federal funding, or if you're federally operated, you can't discriminate on the basis of sex. It's basically a Title IX for healthcare, and it's potentially revolutionary. So I think that would be my favorite part of the new healthcare law.
Where do you think the law goes from here?
Well, I am confident that the Supreme Court's going to uphold the law. And I think as it is implemented, as the more and more people realize and understand the benefits that it provides, that not only will people have greater access to affordable insurance coverage, and not only will their health improve as a result, but I think also people are going to understand that the Affordable Care Act is really important to their lives and actually something that they want to protect. And at the National Women's Law Center, we're working to communicate to women that just that, that this is a truly important piece of legislation which really makes a difference for women and families.
Emily Martin, the Vice President and General Counsel of the National Women's Law Center. Emily, thank you for your time today.
Thank you.
You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. We're joined now by Judy Waxman, the Vice President of Health and Reproductive Rights for the National Women's Law Center. Judy, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
So you have a particular interest in the Supreme Court here just across the street taking on the Affordable Care Act and its constitutionality. What are your thoughts?
I'm very hopeful. We have noted that in the lower courts, a number of very conservative justices have made the same arguments that we have, and we're very hopeful this is going to be a slam dunk.
Judy, what do you think the justices will base their decision on here?
There's a couple of ways they can look at it. Let me tell you, we actually submitted an amicus brief ourselves because there's a lot of really rampant discrimination against women in the healthcare system right now. For example, women get charged more than men, significantly more than men, when they buy health care insurance on their own. In fact, we found that in a recent report, this coming year, women will pay $1 billion more than men for insurance, which is, by the way, the same plan, not including maternity, because maternity care is basically not available on the individual market. And so our brief really talked about that. It said that, you know, in the past, the court has held that civil rights laws are constitutional because they protect people across the country. You know, you cannot say, well, this is my motel, so I'm only going to let people of this race stay here, or I only want to serve this kind of person at my restaurant. And we have said that on the same principle, the non-discrimination against women will disappear under this law. There's a lot of evidence that that was one of the major concerns of the senators and representatives in passing this. And we think on that ground alone, the law can be upheld.
Judy, what excites you most about the health care law?
What excites me most, quite frankly, is that everybody in this country will have insurance and will have a comprehensive plan, meaning women will get maternity care, they will get contraceptive coverage, which, by the way, this whole recent controversy is connected to the Affordable Care Act. I don't know if everybody knows that. And everybody will be able to get coverage and get help to afford it if they can't. And I think we will be a healthier nation.
How do you think that just changes the entire dynamics of the country, some of these things that are in the Affordable Care Act?
That's a great question. I think it really does change things dramatically, because instead of really trying to get a job that has health insurance, people will be freer to start their own businesses. They will be freer to pursue interests that they have. And they will... Everybody, though, no matter how much money you have or not, will be able to get health care coverage so they can be healthy, productive people. It really is a very different future that we're looking at.
Do you think it almost takes a weight off of people's backs, knowing that regardless of the challenges that come their way in life, they will be covered under some sort of health care plan?
Absolutely. I mean, I can speak really for my own daughter, who's just been out of college for a couple of years. She was lucky enough to get a job with health insurance when she graduated college. But if she hadn't, I would be able to keep her on my plan. She wants to do a variety of different things. And partly after she turns 26, even, she won't be able to do it unless she can have some way to get health insurance. And now she'll be able to have that through the Affordable Care Act. So on a very personal level, I see a big weight off her shoulders and mine.
You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, and we're here with Judy Waxman, the Vice President of Health and Reproductive Rights for the National Women's Law Center. Judy, what are you most looking forward to in 2012 around this issue?
Well, I'm looking forward to having the Supreme Court uphold the law, and I think that will happen in 2012. And I think that will mean then that the states who have been dragging their feet about actually implementing it will get the message that it's time to get going, so that they're not behind the eight ball, and that the citizens in every state will be able to take advantage of this new law.
What do you think is a driver behind people changing their mind about the health care law? What is it about it that someone might say initially, I'm not so sure I'm in on that, but later they learn something about it, maybe that changes their mind? What do you think some of those things are?
Well, you've really hit the nail on the head. I think that most people, it turns out, don't know that much about the law. They only hear the rhetoric about taking away my personal liberty or some other stuff like that. But when they hear, and I can speak for the women I talk to, really? We're going to get all this preventive care without a copay? I'll be able to get a whole list of things that will help me stay healthy, including contraceptives, including breastfeeding equipment and counseling, those kind of things, that all of us will have that in our health plans at a reasonable cost. Wow, I didn't know that. Okay, maybe there is some good there in that law.
Judy Waxman, the Vice President of Health and Reproductive Rights for the National Women's Law Center. We appreciate your time today. Thanks for joining us.
Happy to do it.
You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. I'm your host, Jason Fornicola, and up next, we'll continue our healthcare discussion with Ian Millhiser from the Center for American Progress.
Attention AFGE members. Did you know about AFGE's new service to assist you with legal rights issues? It's called the AFGE Legal Rights Attorney Program, which offers free attorney representation in cases brought by AFGE councils and locals on behalf of AFGE members. The program, administered by AFGE's General Counsel's Office, has handled more than 150 cases since 2005 and has won millions of dollars in back pay for our members. The Legal Rights Attorney Program is designed to take cases that will be brought to arbitration, the Merit System Protection Board, or other review boards where both back pay and attorney's fees are available. These cases include removal, suspension, reduction in pay, reduction in grade, and furlough. For information about the program, please email legalrights@afge.org. Not a member? Become one and take advantage of this incredible resource today.
Welcome back to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. We're joined now by Ian Millhiser, a senior constitutional policy analyst with the Center for American Progress. Ian, welcome to the program.
Good to be here. Thanks so much.
So your title fits quite well with the issues of the day today, constitutional. We're kicking off this week with the Supreme Court hearing arguments over the constitutionality of the Affordable Care Act.
That's right.
What are you expecting out of this week?
I mean, I think that the law is going to be upheld, and the reason why is because our Constitution does not give judges the authority to decide what our economic policy is going to be in this country. That belongs to elected officials, and we want it to belong to elected officials. You know, I'm willing to concede that if the other side wins elections, they get what they want. If my side wins elections, we get what we want. And when you allow judges to step in and overrule the will of the people, that starts to get very troubling. We start to look a lot less like a democracy.
What are the dangers of that happening?
I mean, there are certainly some dangers. You know, Bush v. Gore happened. You know, Citizens United happened. So we have to be aware that sometimes these justices put politics ahead of the law. That said, if every single member of the Supreme Court does what they have done in their own past opinions, so they don't have to follow someone else's precedent, they just have to follow what they have personally said, there are 7 votes on the Supreme Court to uphold the Affordable Care Act. So I'm very optimistic going into this.
Talk about the importance, the significance of the issue. We're seeing the Supreme Court spending a lot of time. Mm-hmm. Going to be hearing this for 3 days.
Right.
A lot of time spent on this, which is out of the norm. Do you think that's a signal of how critical they view this issue to be?
It is an unusual amount of time, although I would bear in mind that there are 4 separate issues. Each one of them is just as complex as the other. So, you know, today we are hearing the least sexy issue, something called the Tax Anti-Injunction Act, which I won't bore you with too many details about, beyond that you can tell from the name of that law that's a very complex, there are very complex legal questions that arise out of it. And so I think it's correct that the justices are spending a full hearing on that very complex issue, a full hearing on the other complex issues, and I would read that as being more because they have so many issues in front of them.
For our listeners out there who might not be familiar with the 3 other issues, could you list them for us, please?
Sure thing. So the one that everyone's going to be following the closest is the so-called individual mandate, the requirement that everyone has to either carry health insurance or pay slightly more income taxes. There's also 2 other issues. There's this thing called severability, which is if part of the law goes down, the Supreme Court has to decide if any more of the law has to go down with it. Generally, the justice will apply a very high presumption in favor of keeping as much of the law as possible. So I think that most of the law, no matter what, is here to stay. And then the final issue is the Medicaid expansion. The Affordable Care Act provides Medicaid to many, many more people, and some states don't like that for some reason.
Through your work at the Center for American Progress, where has that taken you? What have you uncovered that maybe some people might not be aware of?
Well, I mean, I thought this was an easy case when I started working on it, and I've written a number of briefs supporting the law. And it's just clearer and clearer to me that we shouldn't even have to be here. You know, the Constitution says that Congress can regulate commerce. This law regulates 1/6 of our nation's economy. So the idea that it's not commercial, I think, is frivolous. And, you know, again, I remain optimistic that it's going to be upheld.
You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, and we're speaking with Ian Millhiser, a senior constitutional policy analyst with the Center for American Progress. Ian, what are the arguments against this law? What's the other side saying?
Well, the other side's argument, and you know, you hear it on cable news all the time, is this idea that it is somewhat offensive that the government is requiring people to buy something, in this case, health insurance. And, you know, all I can really say to that is that the government already requires you to buy things. That's what Medicare is. The government taxes you, and then when you reach a certain age, it buys health insurance for you. So the only issue here is whether the government's allowed to cut out the middleman. And I don't really see why that's a constitutionally significant distinction.
Why is it that in some cases it's okay, people feel it's okay for the government to require them to buy something, but then in a situation like this, it has really stirred emotions, specific emotions in a lot of people. Why do you think that is?
I mean, a lot of this, I think, is just politics. I mean, what you have to keep in mind about the Affordable Care Act is this was the conservative solution to health care for many, many years. It wasn't just that Governor Mitt Romney signed a bill that's almost identical to the Affordable Care Act in structure, but this was incubated in the Conservative Heritage Foundation. A group of very conservative health policy scholars tried to convince the George H.W. Bush administration to adopt this solution. It was the conservative alternative to the Clinton health plan. And so, you know, the same people who are opposed to this law, now, when it didn't have Barack Obama's name on it, we're perfectly willing to support the same exact structure.
Now that we have an understanding of maybe the political side of this, let's talk about how this affects real people,
right?
Everyday working class people.
Well, I mean, I could throw a lot of numbers at you. I could talk about the tens of millions of people who will have health insurance under this law. I could talk about the several million children who already have health insurance. But, you know, if I'm going to play with statistics, I'll throw out one. And that was, there was a Harvard study which showed that 45,000 people die every year because they do not have health insurance. And so when this law goes into effect, that means 45,000 wives will get to hold their husbands again. And it means 45,000 fathers will get to kiss their daughters again. This is a tremendous accomplishment. And it would be such a tragedy if the Supreme Court were to strike it down.
Are you finding even now, obviously 2014, we're going to have a full rollout, but at the start of last year, a few of these things were already put in place as they come along.
Mm-hmm.
Are you finding that even those things, something like a family allowing their son or daughter to stay on their policy up to the age of 26, those things, do you find that resonating with real people out there?
It certainly resonates with the people who are benefiting from it. There is no question that the people who have, you know, whose children have received health care, who have themselves received health care, support this law. And as more and more people benefit from it, I believe it's going to come to be viewed as one of our greatest policy achievements of the last several decades.
When do you expect the Supreme Court to rule on this issue?
Probably will be about June. Normally for big cases like this, we don't get to hear from the justices till the end of the Supreme Court term. So it's probably going to be just in time for the presidential election to heat up.
What are the implications there then based on a ruling that might come in June?
Well, you know, I am more concerned about the implications for our Constitution because, like I said at the beginning, if the justices have the power to say it doesn't matter what elected officials do and it doesn't matter what the Constitution says, we're going to impose our will on the American people, then our elections are irrelevant. You know, then it really doesn't matter who wins because the only people who are in charge are five people on the Supreme Court of the United States.
Ian Millhiser, the senior constitutional policy analyst for the Center for American Progress. Thank you for your time and your insight here today.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you to our guest this week, Roger Hickey from the Campaign for America's Future, GovLoop's Steve Ressler, Emily Martin and Judy Waxman from the National Women's Law Center, and Ian Millhiser from the Center for American Progress. I'm your host, Jason Fornicola, and that's The View from Inside Government.
Thank you for listening to Inside Government, brought to you in part by Purchasing Power and MetLife. Attention AFGE members, are you in need of a new computer or home appliance but can't spare the upfront cash? Discover Purchasing Power, an exclusive benefit available to AFGE members where you can buy brand name laptops, tablets, and home appliances through 12 months of easy payroll deduction. No upfront cash or credit check required. Shop now and get an 8% AFGE member only discount with promo code AFGE member. That's all.